we go back and actually look at this. And what's interesting is we see today, Adam, the same specter of both civil war and external war rising, mm-hmm. right, in America. I often point out to people that, you know, I'm a demographer, I look at surveys all the time. And 10 years ago, no one even surveyed the question, is a civil war likely in America, right? Now, that question is asked all the time, and about half of Americans think it's likely. But you also have the prospect of geopolitical conflict, obviously, both in the Western Pacific, you know, with the threat from China, and obviously a major land war now happening in Europe. And these, I think, have also focused the mind of a lot of people. We are entering into an era where we see the prospect of major history happening both internally and externally. And as I point out, this is exactly in consonance with what we usually see in fourth turnings. We usually see both things happening at once.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. It's said that history unfolds in cycles, that civilizations and societies boom, bust, and then rise anew to repeat the pattern, a pattern that's surprisingly predictable in both its timing and trajectory. Today's guest expert is demographer Neil Howe, co-author of the book The Fourth Turning, a seminal work in which he and his fellow researcher William Strauss laid out the evidence for these seasons of societal change that they referred to as turnings. When that book first came out in 1997, Howe and Strauss warned that the next societal winter, the next fourth turning, to use their label, would begin early on in the new millennium. In his brand new sequel, The Fourth Turning Is Here, Howe reveals that we are now indeed deep within a fourth turning that started roughly in 2008, commensurate with the global financial crisis. Our current society has entered the bust part of its cycle, where the status quo falls apart, often chaotically. What should we expect from this period of disruption? Are there steps we can take to improve our odds of persevering? And perhaps more importantly, how can we position ourselves to play a constructive role and possibly thrive as this fourth turning concludes, to be replaced, as history suggests, by a new and hopefully better order? Now it's time to hear from the author himself. Neil, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, Adam. It's great to be here.
Well, Neil, look, I'm so excited to talk to you. We've had a lot of people asking for you to come on this channel. They're super excited to hear about your new book, which I have a copy of right here. Very thick. You can see the immense amount of work that went into this. Lots to talk about here, Neil. Incredibly germane to the times that we're living in. Before I get into the detailed questions here, can you just give our audience a quick summary of your generational theory and its archetypes and turnings? This is just for folks that may not have, you know, been familiar with your previous work.
This is something that Bill Strauss and I developed originally back in the late 1980s. We did a book called Generations, retelling the story of America as a sequence of generational biographies, really starting with the Puritan generation coming to New England in the 1630s, the Great Migration going all the way up to what at that time was the 14th American generation, millennials, who at that time were little kids. They didn't have a name yet. In fact, at the time we wrote, even Generation X did not have a name. So we thought these kids we expected would be the high school class of 2000, so we named them millennials. So if you want to know where the name millennial comes from, there it is, 1991 in our book Generations. But that was a method, and we were not interested, Adam, originally in looking at cycles of history. We were really interested in patterns of generational change. And we noticed that generation did come in patterns. You know, certain kinds of generations always followed others. For instance, after a very idealistic, utopian generation rebelling against the institutions of their parents, like boomers, there always followed a more cynical, materialistic, survivalist generation like Xers. This is not the first time this happened. It's happened repeatedly in American history. You look back at the generation of Abraham Lincoln and Ralph Waldo Emerson and Walt Whitman, and they were followed by a generation of metal and muscle. This would have been George Armstrong Custer and Ulysses Grant. They weren't big talkers. They did the dirty work, right? And they got big jobs done. And then similarly, following these wild generations come much more protected generations, as we've seen about millennials following Xers. But you understand my point. There's certain rhythms in generational change, and these rhythms are actually associated with corresponding rhythms in history itself. And that was something we noticed at the end of generations, but we made it the leading thesis of the book we wrote in 1997 called The Fourth Turning. And that was that the something that many historians have noticed, that the great periods of civic upheaval, of public mobilization, great wars, and the kind of reconstruction of our national outer world, politics, economics, infrastructure, and so on, occur about the length of a long human lifetime apart. And we had a famous period in the late 17th century, the period of the Glorious Revolution and Bacon's Rebellion and, you know, King Philip's War and so on, a notorious period of rebellion in the colonies. And then roughly a long human lifetime afterwards, we had the American Revolution. And then a long human lifetime after we had been the Civil War. And then we had the Great Depression, World War II. And then here we are again today, Adam, the next great period of disruption. And roughly halfway in between these civic upheavals, we have the great awakenings of American history, where we reconstruct the inner world of values, religion, literature, art, and so on. And these are very conveniently in American history, we number them. We call it the First Great Awakening, the Second Great Awakening, and so on. And so we've had those two, and many historians think of the late 60s and 70s as America's fourth or fifth great awakening, depending on when you want to start your count. But this alternation between inner world and outer world leads to a set of archetypes. In other words, different generations that are differently situated in history. Some generations are come of age during awakenings, like boomers. Some generations are raised as children during awakenings, like Xers. Some generations are born and raised after awakenings in a much more protected environment, like millennials. And some generations are the children of the next crisis. These are four archetypes, and they correspond with the four turnings of history, which we liken to seasons. If you think of America after World War II, we all, often refer to William O'Neill, the historian, talked about the American High, which was the presidencies of Truman and Eisenhower and John Kennedy, late 1940s, 50s, early 1960s. That would have been America's first turning, right? The beginning of the saeculum following the last crisis, right? And that's the springtime of the saeculum. And that's when institutions are strong, individualism is weak. Society feels a very strong sense of collective purpose about where it wants to move, even though individuals don't feel very free to move within that system, right? I mean, there's a strong conformity that surrounds people. The second turning, which is the summer season, is the awakening. And that's when we throw off all those social obligations, right? And that's when the prophet archetype is coming of age, like boomers, leading that charge. You know, we no longer want to dress to please others. We no longer want to choose careers to please others. We want to do whatever the hell we want to do. And in the last instance, it started in the culture, particularly on college campuses, often in inner cities. And it ended really with the economy. We wanted tax cuts, deregulation. On every front, we wanted just to do our own thing, right? And it led to a period of increasing individualism in American society, a widening gap between rich and poor, obviously. I think boomers have been very tolerant of increasing differences between social classes. You remember the one thing boomers hated most coming of age was this huge oppressive middle class. And they hated that. Pleasant Valley Sunday everywhere, right? And so they wanted more freedom for people to just go and move in different directions. And it's interesting, you have, so boomers hated the orderliness of that world. And it's funny because today you have almost an opposite reaction. You talk to millennials today and it's like middle class. They say, it sounds great. Where do I sign up? I don't see it. I don't see it anywhere. So that's what happens. Now the fall season is like we call it the third turning. And that would have been, you know, the late 1980s, the 1990s, the early 00s. And that's a period that's the opposite of the high. That's a period of rising individualism, weakening civic trust, weakening institutions. If you think of famous third turning decades, it would have been the roaring 90s or the roaring 20s or the 1850s or the 1760s. These were all decades of cynicism and bad manners and sort of weak attachment to civic life generally. People didn't really care too much about it. I think in the late 1990s, along with the dot-com bubble, the leitmotif of those years was Francis Fukuyama's End of History. Remember that? Individualism is triumphant. Markets were triumphant. All the great causes of history were over. And government would just sort of melt away, leaving individuals around the world just to self-actualize and to enjoy the diversity of all their choices. Right? No sense of community whatsoever. Well, the fourth turning is when we rediscover community. And the generation coming of age, instead of wanting less order, wants more order. And that really is what causes the cold front to move in, right? You think about the weather analogy, right? It's not like a warm front moving in, it's like a cold front moving in. And exploring exactly what a fourth turning is and exactly how it transpires and in which stages is something I try to do in this book in a lot more close detail than I did in the earlier book that I did with Bill. Do you remember? Because at that time, the fourth turning was still way out there. You know, we only had vague analogies to draw upon. Now we're really in it, right? So there's, I think, more to say. More detail to draw out. And one last thing, Adam, and that is, as you know from reading the book, I spend a fair amount of time talking about the world we're going to move into, because in a way, it's where we're headed, this first turning. And one way to really understand the overall trajectory is to look at this coming world of the first turning. And you think about this, maybe I'll just stop this with one analogy. Think of how America changed from the late 1920s. I mean, you know, a decade when young people were rum runners and the gin fizz crowd, and they were all crowding on top of flagpoles, just doing zany. I mean, the whole country was kind of crazy. It was the movable feast, celebrity circuses. It was a wild time in America, very weak sense of civic life. Think of how it changed from then until the early 1950s. Wow, what a change in the culture, in the role of government, in our society, in our economy, in the sense of the national community, the sense of America's role in the world. What a change. What would it be like going from the early 00s, you know, that time of where the dot-com bubble, or just any time around then, the mortgage mania? Do you remember that time? Everyone was buying houses and kind of the stupid era, to the mid or the late 2030s. And that's really what I'm thinking about. How is that world? And I think that's a really great, just as the last decade and a half we've seen has been a lot like the 1930s in so many respects, socially, economically, geopolitically around the world. I think where we're going, the analogy also holds. And I think that's an interesting way to think about overall trajectory.
Wow, Neil, that was a fantastic intro to the whole discussion here. So I do want to get to what you see coming in the new first turning, you know, after this fourth turning, because that's what really matters, right? And also that's really where the hope in the story lies, right? But I've found, as I'm sure you have too, where if you tell somebody, all right, you're going to take some pain to get some gain later on, you really have to talk to them about the pain before they even open their mind to what the gain is going to be. So let's dive into sort of what you see coming in the rest of this fourth turning. But before we do, Really quickly, I should have mentioned earlier when I held up this book, it's just recently made the New York Times bestseller list. So first off, I want to congratulate you on that impressive accomplishment.
Thank you.
But I'm curious, like, you know, you wrote this seminal work back in 1997. It has largely played out as predicted. What parts about how this has unfolded have felt validating to you? Like, oh, we really nailed that part right. And what parts, if any, of how things have unfolded have surprised you as this fourth turning really has arrived in full force?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think what's most fulfilling to me is really following our generational method. I think how each of the generations has turned out is very close to what Bill and I originally foresaw. That is to say, a boomer generation entering, you know, old age, seeing itself as a generation of visions and values, you know, often, you know, very principled, uncompromising, whatever, you know, wherever they are, whether in the red zone or the blue zone, and in churches or in college campuses, right? And then this very kind of pragmatic, low self-esteem, kind of low-profile Gen Xers.
Xers, we're still the same, yep.
still kind of lurking, you know, not quite deciding whether they really want to tune in. Often pleased to see arguments between boomers and millennials, because that way they still get to sort of, you know, remain in the background. A generation very slow, as we predicted, to rise into public life. This generation is slower to assume leadership as governors, members of Congress, and obviously the presidency, than any other generation in American history. We expected that. We also expected that it might be ideologically a little bit out of sync. Gen X shows every sign, particularly if you adjust them for their age, of being the most Republican generation today. You know, this is the generation that most supported Trump. You know, after the 2020 election, they are the generation that feels at one with the left out crowd. You know, those who were sort of overlooked by all those with all those fancy credentials and so on. A little bit of a that wounded sense of grievance, you know, that Gen Xers have often had. I think, however, that this generation will become, as all other nomad archetypes have been in midlife, absolute fulcrum that this country will rely upon to move into the better era. We've seen it again and again. This is the generation that, without complaint, actually gets the big things done, right? Because they're in midlife. I mean, they're the generals, they're the CEOs, they're the people actually making decisions in the midst of the crisis. Boomers are moving on, and millennials are not yet in those top positions yet. And focusing on how this generation actually behaves in midlife is actually, you know, as you know, one big part of the discussion in my book, right? Who is this generation in midlife? And when have we seen this type of generation before? And how do they approach kind of midlife leadership, even if Gen Xers don't really think of themselves ever as leaders, right? And then millennials, which I think is the generation that we always foresaw, even when they were small children, you know, special, confident, very protected, very risk averse, and very community oriented. I mean, this is a generation obsessed with doing things in groups. FOMO is their middle name, right? Fear of missing out. They always want to do things with each other, and they always want to do things as a big group. You know, that's in investing. I mean, how do millennials invest? Well, it's a, you know, defined contribution retirement plans are now, you know, opt out rather than opt in, right? So that they're all sort of automatically funneled into these things, and they go to target date funds, which essentially has a bunch of experts manage their funds all into some huge ETF that represents everything, right? So they're basically crowdfunding themselves. And what that means is that if the market goes down, they all go down with each other, which is great for millennials because there's no FOMO. The worst fear of millennials is going down without your peers, right? So if they all invest in the same thing, and actually that's what we saw actually with John Steinbeck and a lot of the early wave GIs who were born in the first decade of the 20th century, commenting on the 1930s, they said actually that the Great Depression wasn't so bad because we were all poor together. We could all go down. I mean, John Steinbeck is just talking about going down to the orchard and, you know, they just took apples off the trees. And, you know, we had a lot of time. We talked about life. We weren't burning ourselves out trying to be accountants and lawyers anymore because there weren't any jobs for that. But that sense of having the pressure taken off, I think that sense that Xers never had of being in this very large group that's all going somewhere together. They don't know where it is yet. Whereas Xers, of course, always separated into little niches of winners and losers, right? Xers always wanted to get the edge on their peers.
So, right. Well, we always felt like latchkey kids, no matter what happened, right? We were just alone.
And the difference is, too, is that Xers are all still, their entire generation is going to be total traffic accident anyway. It's going to be total loss. So you figured if you alone are successful, that was your one, you know, to do better than your peers is the one way to get out of this catastrophe. Whereas I think millennials are always told that they're going to do very well, right? You're the hope of America's future. So that their best bet was to try to crowd in with each other. Very different. So I would say one of my big discoveries and sort of one ways in which we've sort of adjusted the theory is just to this dilation of generational lengths and the saeculum length a little bit. So, and it's interesting because if you look back historically over this sort of entire Anglo-American history going way back, the saecula and the turnings used to be a little bit longer and they got shorter. You know, in the 19th century, the early 20th century, generations came of age at younger ages. They got married at younger ages. A growing economy allowed people to leave home at younger ages and get, you know, very productive careers. And so actually generational leadership was somewhat accelerated. People became presidents actually at younger ages, around, you know, 1900, 1910, 1920, than they did, you know, a century earlier. But I think today it's beginning to revert, right? And I think that the economy today for a young adult has more in common with the economy of, I don't know, 1700 than the economy of 1900 or 1950, in the sense that as in the early modern era, when, you know, kind of an agrarian economy did not grow very fast, right? And it took a while to set up a new household. People left home back in the late 17th century, early 18th century. They left home in their late 20s. Nutrition was poor. Women weren't fertile until their late teens. I mean, you have to remember how different this was. And no one had, you know, pregnancies out of wedlock. You really had to get married to have kids, and you had to leave home to have kids. And you had to set up a new household, which meant you needed land, you needed tools. You had to wait, right, to start families. And as a demographer, I know this, but a lot of people don't know this. I know, right. When I talk to people, they often think, you know, three centuries ago, we all bred like rabbits. You know what I mean? We all, you know, everyone married in their teens. They say, absolutely not.
Sorry to interject on this, but so I grew up in New England, and there was something called a bedboard that when you got married, if your husband was still living at home, you would often sleep in the same bed as the parents, and there would be a dividing board between the parent side of the bed and the newlywed side of the bed. It just sounds awful. But to your point, like it was taking people a lot longer to eject from the house and create their own.
A lot longer. And in fact, the norm was you really weren't allowed to get married while you still lived at home. And that was actually a hallmark of sort of Western Europe, the whole Western European. Asia was a little bit different, and Asia had faster demographic growth, you know, particularly in those centuries. But Europe was different, and Europe actually had very slow demographic growth during those centuries, mainly due to very low fertility, because it took a lot longer for families fully economically come of age. And obviously, you know, child mortality was higher. We know everything else was obviously very different. But I do think that we're slowing down a little bit in the pace of the cycle. And that just means adjusting a little bit. You know, Bill and I thought about something that, you know, a fourth turning would climax in the mid 2020s. And now we're sort of saying, well, maybe, you know, at least I'm saying, you know, 2030 or early 2030s, you know what I mean? A little bit later than before. That's an interesting adjustment. And I think young people are really aware of that. You know, the fact that older people are still just, you know, incumbents. They're still monopolizing all these places. A lot of Xers keep wondering, when are these boomers leave, you know, retire so they can move up? I mean, it's like musical chairs, right? I mean, people have to leave so other people can move up and be decision makers. And of course, that speeds up the pace of history as younger people, you know, move up into those higher leadership roles.
All right. Interesting. So, well, first, congrats on nailing the archetypes, and interesting that sort of the expansion of the turnings of the saeculum is one of the things that caught your attention, especially because, like, you would think, you know, with technology and everything, it feels like everything's speeding up, and it is to a certain extent, but apparently not in the duration of these turnings.
I often, you know, ask people about this whole technology speeding up, and it's amazing. We always focus on the speed of whatever we're paying attention to. So today, you know, it's this gadget I've got right here, right? You know, it does amazing things. So this is what I think of as speeding up, right? And yet everything else in my life has like slowed down to like zero. I mean, I'm driving the same internal combustion automobile that my parents were driving when I was a tiny kid. The same highways, the same bridges, all the external infrastructure, not only the same type of bridges, I mean, the same bridges. I mean, even the thing hasn't changed. It was built by the GI generation during and just after World War II, and it literally hasn't changed ever since. So much of our life is stationary, you know, in terms of our public technology, in terms of how we actually live, land use, and all the rest. I sometimes ask people, if you had taken a look at the life cycle of, say, someone born in the late 1880s, say Eisenhower, right? Say Ike. Let's take Ike's lifetime. So he was born in the late 1880s. He grew up in a world where kings and queens still rule of Europe. Hertz Kautz drew things on cities. There were no such thing as telephones had hardly been invented. Obviously, were never used. Most Americans still used outhouses. We had no planes. You just think of the kind of world we live in, and right. People hauled huge pieces of ice up tenements, you know, to put in their refrigerator. I mean, the way we live,
there's icebox, air
conditioning. Yeah, icebox. By the time Eisenhower was in his second term of president, he was flying in a 707. I think that was the Air Force One back then. He was flying in a jet airplane, and he was writing memos about the future plans to land. And this was actually just prior to Jack Kennedy's arrival in the White House. He was writing memos about plans to put a man on the moon. I mean, you want to talk about a lifetime of change. I mean, let's talk about his lifetime and then say, how many of us have lived through those changes, right?
Right.
And I think it gives us a sense of humility. I think we always think that our lifetime is filled with such changes. Well, maybe not. And in any case, I do think that when he was, you know, fully coming of age, and when he was acting upon the world, America was going through a period of tremendous rapid growth, and people were actually moving into their careers, moving into marriages at younger ages than today. And it makes you wonder about, you know, if life is rushed today for young people, what do we call it back in 1960? You know, when people were moving into buying houses and automobiles and had their first child on the way at age 21, that was not unusual. Anyway, this is food for thought. And I do have some reflections on that in the book. And I think we tend to get skewed a little bit in how we view the pace of change.
Okay. All right. Well, look, I want to get to where all this is headed and really the whole topic of rebirth. I want to end on, you know, both the optimism element of that, but also just if that's where the puck's headed, like how do we prepare for that? But first, let's get to the devolution of the current order, because fourth turnings is really where the status quo falls apart and is then replaced by the new saeculum, right? So do you see the, you know, we're here in 2023. This may last into the early 2030s, as you mentioned. Is this sort of like an exponential decline where it's sort of falling apart, but then there's sort of a watershed, you know, where just everything just sort of, you know, blows up and then a new system rises from the ashes? Do you see something different? So I'll let you answer this any way you like, but I think the question most people have in their mind is, Neil, how bad is this going to get?
It will get worse, but then it gets better. And I think the point to remember is conflict, right? I mean, that's how the creative destruction of public institutions take place. It takes place through conflict. And one of the things, this is true of all fourth turnings. It is true in other countries. It's true and certainly in our own history. All of the total wars we have fought have been in fourth turnings. And in fact, all of our fourth turnings have had total wars, and others have had a perfect correspondence going back. And it's one question that people ask, which I think is a good one. I spend a fair amount of time talking about that. Is the conflict mainly internal or external, or is it some combination of both? Right. And I discuss that at some length, and I do think it's a question of degree. It's very often both at the same time in a really odd way.
And Neil, sorry to interrupt, but just to help people understand, by external, you mean maybe like
geopolitical conflict,
a foreign war where there's an invader that we have to deal with, or an internal one might be like a crushing wealth divide disparity.
Or a civil war or a revolution or just something that's internal. And what's interesting is when you look at it, civil wars always have an external dimension. External wars always have an internal dimension, and both usually loom during a fourth turning. It's interesting that the Great Depression, World War II, which climaxed with World War II, started with a decade of intense polarization of America in terms of politics. Right? I mean, we had FDR won in 1932 and huge victory in 1936 and polarized America. I mean, if you talk to Democrats or those who favored the Popular Front and the New Deal, they called the 1930s the fascist decade. And in fact, fascists were taking over many countries around the world. But if you had talked to conservatives and Republicans, they called the 1930s the red decade, you know, because there was that going on as well, you know, in the 1930s. And what they had in common was there was no middle ground. Everyone was giving up on democracy. Democracy was finished, right? I mean, that was people's opinion. Liberal democracy and capitalism was done for. It was either communism or fascism. Take your pick. And if you had asked an American, most Americans probably in the late 1930s, when we were still signing the Oxford Pledge, you know, young people signing the Oxford Pledge, I will never... You know, if asked by my country to fight in war, I will not fight. You know what I mean? It was still the hangover of World War I isolationism. And you would ask them, if you had told them, we're going to have a huge crisis in this country in a few years, what will it be? They probably would have said a civil war, right? I mean, they would have looked at it. They would have looked in right versus left. They would have FDR and his enemies. In fact, Sinclair Lewis wrote a novel called It Can't Happen Here about a fascist takeover in America. You had Huey Long, you had Father Coughlin, you had these demagogues that were rising. You had an intensely polarized and intensely mobilized electorate. You had everyone voting in the 1930s. And we've seen the same thing, by the way, recently in America. We now have it had in 2020, 2022, 2018, we've had the highest voter participation rates in a century. Say what you might about Donald Trump. He certainly has solved the problem of voter apathy in America. I mean, think about it. I mean, everyone's mobilized. Everyone's going to vote again. Everyone thinks that the fate of the country rests on it.
And sorry to interrupt, but we've had some of the closest elections too at this volume, which speaks to the polarization you're talking about.
And that actually intensifies the polarization. I think the size of FDR's victory actually tended to tamp down the polarization a little bit because it gave one side so much more leverage than the other. I do think that so many other parallels as well. I mean, we had according to VDEM and Freedom House, the share of the world living in freedom and democracies, you know, peaked in 2007, just before the GFC, and it's been falling ever since. The share of global trade as a share of global production peaked in 2007, just before the GFC. Well, this is exactly like the 1930s, right? We had the 1930s was when dictatorships were taking over. You know, from Germany to Eastern Europe to Spain to my gosh, hey, look at South Asia and what was happening in Asia at the time. But we see some of these same trends, the rise of populism and authoritarianism around the world, the decline of the concerted nations, you know, which managed world affairs, and the complete breakup of the League of Nations. We see the same thing today, right? People wondering who's going to guide global affairs. Well, there's no consensus anymore. And the dividing up of the world into different spheres, we now see with the sanctions program after the Ukraine. You remember the Japan's co-prosperity sphere in the late 1930s and so forth, and the desperate search for commodities in these different areas of the world where you seek for commodities. I mean, Hitler going east to find oil, and Japan wanting to go through the Philippines down to Indochina for oil. Of course, eventually giving us Pearl Harbor in World War II. But these are trends we see today, right? There's so much that echoes, and that also is something I talk about. But I think what's interesting to point out is that it's almost miraculous and crazy that after all of that division, suddenly America mobilized itself for an external threat. And I actually talk about that. I go through and talk about how that happened. In the Civil War, which obviously was a civil war, I mean, that was about as internal as you get. Typically what happens in a civil war is one side or the other, usually the losing side, wants to go after external allies, right? The South was after Spain and France to get in the war, almost succeeded. I think if Robert E. Lee had won at Antietam, he could have done it. Lincoln, not only won that battle, but issued the Emancipation Proclamation a week afterward. And I think that completely eliminated the possibility that France or England would side with Richmond. In the American Revolution, which we think of as an external conflict, at the time it was thought of as a civil war. It was an internal conflict. Most of the deaths were American colonists killing other American colonists, particularly in the South, where it was an absolutely vicious guerrilla war, right, among Americans. Namely, you know, backcountry, you know, loyalists versus the, you know, the grandees who were mainly on the patriot side. And as you know, the weaker side, Washington, tried to get an alliance with France, did it. And it's one of the reasons why Britain gave up the struggle. But we go back and actually look at this. And what's interesting is we see today, Adam, the same specter of both civil war and external war rising, mm-hmm. right, in America. I often point out to people that, you know, I'm a demographer, I look at surveys all the time, and 10 years ago, no one even surveyed the question, is a civil war likely in America, right? Now, that question is asked all the time, and about half of Americans think it's likely, right? When you look at the mood today and the complete non-cooperation in legislatures and Congress. I mean, you know, it's a little bit like the 1850s. I mean, you know, the Democrats and Republicans don't talk to each other anymore. I mean, there's really nothing left to talk about. That, you have that, and the upcoming prospect of another, you know, Trump candidacy and all the rest. But you also have the prospect of geopolitical conflict, obviously, both in the Western Pacific, you know, with the threat from China and obviously a major land war now happening in Europe. And these, I think, have also focused the mind of a lot of people. We are entering into an era where we see the prospect of major history happening both internally and externally. And as I point out, this is exactly in consonance with what we usually see in fourth turnings. We usually see both things happening at once, as we saw during the 1930s.
All right. So obviously that's very concerning, right? You know, we hope that we'll...
It is concerning. But here's the thing, that in these moments of duress is when we become most creative publicly. And there's a chapter in the book, I think it's chapter 8, where we talk about the social transformations of a fourth turning. And obviously the major theme is from individualism to community. I mean, that's sort of the overarching theme, right? From beginning to end. But the themes in addition within that are from privilege to equality. We become a more equal society by the end of a fourth turning. And that's very important to remember. When Thomas Piketty wrote his book, Capital, you remember this was a few years ago, you know, yep. A big tome came out. And he said that, well, you know, because the rate of return on capital always exceeds the rate of economic growth, the rich always get richer, you know, all the usual stuff. But he said, oh, yeah, there was a great exception during the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. You remember that, you know, that the great compression is what economists call it, when incomes became more equal during the 30s, 40s, and then during the 1950s, really during the fourth turning and the first turning. And this happens again and again in history. During great crises, we become more equal. And once this crisis further heats up, we're going to see that happen again. These are, you know, Walter Scheidel wrote a wonderful book called The Great Leveler, and really talking about equality and history, how societies, urban societies at peace and prosperity always become more unequal. They only become more unequal, more equal when they hit crises, right? Revolution, state failure, total war, epidemic. I mean, he goes down the list, right? It sort of sounds like the four horsemen of the apocalypse, but that's always when we become more equal, not only during the crisis itself, but during the social reconstruction that follows. We become more equal. And then peace and prosperity, complacency, we become less equal. This is the pattern of the saeculum, and we see it in American history time and again. So we see this as another thing, which is I think, positive. People regard that as positive, not just more equal in terms of income and wealth in a kind of Gini coefficient sense, but the ethic of social equality. You know, just the whole idea that we shared in a common struggle, we all went through it together. Thinking of ourselves more as citizens. When the GIs who came out of World War II, the greatest generation, I think it wasn't just that they were, you know, all lived in, didn't mind all living in similar houses in the suburbs, right? Mm-hmm. Little boxes that all looked the same, but they also treated each other as equal. They dressed similarly. Their what they consumed was similar. They didn't want to stand out particularly in that way. There was a social ethic that didn't just have to do with dollar numbers. There's another aspect. I think one further thing I talk about is the transition from deferring problems to solving long-term problems, right? Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that happens. If you ask most people, particularly policy analysts, when's the best time to actually reform our whole, you know, all of our policies? When's the best time to reform our policies, right? Do everything rationally, solve all these problems, quit buying off, you know, the big lobbyists and, you know, paying people off to do stupid things. Why don't we just solve things for the sake of the common good? And if you ask most people, they say, you know, the best time to do it is a time of prosperity on a sunny day. You know, there's no recession. You know, we got surpluses built up. It's perfect time to do it. And that may be the reasonable approach, but history shows that's never.
But nobody does it. That's not human nature. Yeah, exactly.
It's not in our nature. And history shows it never happens that way. We always make our biggest, boldest, longest term decisions on a dark, stormy day when our backs are up against the wall And even the short-term future of our republic is in doubt. That's when we frame the new constitutions. You know, during the Civil War, when Congress itself thought occasionally it might be attacked by Confederates. You know, that's when they, you know, developed the income tax. They nationalized the currency. They legislated the Transcontinental Railroad. They you know set up land grant colleges in the states. And obviously they you know passed the 13th, 14th, and you know the 15th Amendments. Right? I mean they granted equality under the Constitution. But all of these things were done at the worst possible time, and similarly during the New Deal, the sort of legislation of the whole new political economy of the post-war America was legislated at a time when unemployment rate was in the double digits, GDP was declining. I'm thinking of the legislation of the cornerstone of the welfare state, which we have today, which is not just Social Security and SSI and you know, TANF and just all these state local program and all of that stuff from food stamps to God knows what was all originally legislated in 1935 with budget projections going up to 1975 and 1980. This was a time when the economy, when particularly when it was being discussed in 1934, it looked just horrible. We saw governments in Europe that were falling to fascist dictatorships. We had negative GDP growth. We had double-digit unemployment. We still had people in food lines. And yet here was planners actually implementing these huge long-term programs, these huge long-term frameworks. And typically coming out of fourth turnings is when we undertake our largest infrastructure growth, right? As we did coming out of World War II. These are the positives. And when anyone says, well, that's a really dangerous time, you know, people have, you know, nations have nuclear weapons now, you're talking about conflict, this looks really dangerous. I say, yes, it will be a dangerous time, and it's very important how we navigate through it. But think about this. What could be worse than an indefinite continuation of current trends? I mean, if you want something depressing, right, the ultimate devolution of everything, right, where you have increasing loneliness and despair in the cities, you know what I mean, and just increasing sense of hopelessness about any national community or anything, and a sense of total public dysfunction in which we can't do anything at all publicly, and a complete sort of degradation of the political economy where, you know, major industries are kind of claiming markets for themselves, you know, major incumbents, whether it's, you know, the banks or whether it's the airlines or whether it's big tech and so on, with no sense of national community whatsoever. If you think about current trends indefinitely extended, I think that's worse. That's worse than a fourth turn. And I think that's what most Americans will realize, that they say, yeah, a period of a rite of passage historically through to a new era sounds painful, but where we're going, I mean, that just sounds hopeless, right? Because there's no destination there.
That's a great point. And certainly, you know, a lot on this channel, we talk a lot about these sort of societal ills that are becoming increasingly clear here, right? And you're right. If we just continue at these trajectories, you just lose hope the further along you go along them, especially if you're not in the top 0.1% of the populace that seems to be hoovering up all of the opportunity as time goes on here. What I hear you saying is sort of like, you know, it's the doctor delivering the good news, which says, look, you got cancer, but we're going to cure it for you. We're going to get you into remission. You're just going to have to go through a really painful process to get there. There's going to be maybe surgery, radiation, and chemo. So get ready for this. It's not going to be a fun journey, but you're going to be in a better state at the time we get through it. I'm also reminded of a Churchill quote I'm sure you've heard it, the one about Americans. I love Americans. They always do the right thing after they've exhausted every other possible option. And it seems like that's how we sort of face fourth turnings, right? Where all the big reforms that we know we need to do, we don't really do them until we're actually forced to do them by circumstances, but we do them and we set the stage for a better future there. So let me ask you two questions here. One is, does history give us any guidance as just a citizen, knowing that you're going through a fourth turning? And maybe this is the first citizenry we have that is conscious of this seasonality to society. Is there any kind of tips, best practices for the average person just going through this to try to not become collateral damage of the unwinding of the fourth turning?
Well, I think the first, I mean, one thing is more sort of internal, the other is external. I think more the internal thing is to realize that it's good to know. I think it's constructive to know, maybe even comforting to know that there are longer term patterns which we participate in that give us roles which we can perform well or badly, right? We're not just dangling randomly out at the end of history with no idea what follows. And I often talk to historians. Most historians believe that history is completely random. The 1960s followed the 1950s, but it could have been the other way around, right? The 1950s could have followed the 1960s. And I'm wondering, you know, I actually don't think it works that way. I think that's kind of like water moving uphill, you know, water regathering at the top of a waterfall. There are certain historical processes that only work one way. And much of what I talk about, and particularly in my discussions on complex systems in nature and likening generational rhythms to a complex system, that there are things which only happen one way. If we want to go from a third turning, a fall, to a spring, you have to go through a crisis. That's the only route. You can't go backwards. You can't go back to through an awakening to a first turning. You know what I mean? That's just not an option. Time's arrow only moves one way. The laws of entropy only move history one way. And we see again and again processes in nature like this. Forests need fires, you know, sometimes in order even for certain seeds to germinate. They have to get hot for new things to germinate. Rivers need floods, you know, to clear themselves out. And societies need these periods of creative destruction. They are necessary. And before getting to sort of, you know, personally what you can do, I do quote William James in the book. I think he was a great thinker. I think he was a great man. He once gave a famous speech at Stanford in 1906, 1907, near the earthquake. Anyway, there at Stanford University, but he gave a speech, a famous speech, which I think most Americans have heard of. It's called The Moral Equivalent of War. And he talks about how war is necessary for inculcating all of the civic attributes that are positive about state creation. You know, it trains people to think about, you know, the commonweal, sacrifice for the common good, you know, to recognize that their fellow citizens, you know, they have duties to them and they have their reciprocal duties. It trains people to face adversity. And he goes through all these positive things. He says, we can't imagine. And I'm telling you all this because he himself was a pacifist. You know, he did not fight during the Civil War, very, very different from Oliver Wendell Holmes, you know, sort of his peer, who obviously did serve and gave many speeches as well on war. But he said, is it possible to do these things without a war? And he kind of goes, you know, says, could we have a moral equivalent of war, you know, to teach all these things to the next rising generation? And he sounds less convincing when he says that. But in this speech, in other words, he's not totally convinced that it's possible. I think if you actually read the speech, I don't think he's fully convinced that that's possible. But he said something fascinating, I thought. He basically asked people, and you have to remember when he's saying this in 1906, he said, I want to ask all of you if you think it would have been better if America had never gone through the Civil War. Now, that's kind of interesting, right? Many people who went through the Civil War are still in the audience, and certainly their parents were still living. And he immediately answered his own question. He says, I'm sure almost no one in the audience would say it would have been better. We could hardly imagine the sense of progress in America, the industrial progress, the unification of the nation, you know, the guarantee of rights. And he went to list all of the things that positive that came out of the Civil War. We couldn't imagine that, right? Of course, we're glad that we went through that period of crisis. It made us a much more powerful and better nation. And then he asked this next question. If I were to ask you all whether you would all want to go through that again a few years from now, he said, I imagine all of you would say no. And he said, isn't that a paradox? Now, I think that that paradox is no different than our personal life. So I ask you, Adam, think of a period in your life. I don't know, you were divorced, you lost a loved one, your career went to hell. I mean, you know, we all have moments that we went through. And then you ask yourself, would you have rather that you didn't go through that? And amazingly enough, I think most of us would say no. I actually grew from that. I became a better person. I became a stronger person. I actually was able to marshal certain resources I never would have discovered had it not been for that, right? And I think it's very much the same for nations as is with people. But if you ask most people, hey, do you want to go through that again next year? I mean, most of us would say, you're crazy. Of course not, right? But this is how we face rites of passage. It's the same for us collectively as it is for us individually. Now, you ask, what should we do as individuals? I think a few basic rules. The first thing I tell people is that during fourth turnings, the generosity of government is cut back. So a lot of the things you expect and benefits and guarantees and insurance and everything else will get cut back. Because during the peak of public mobilization, you know, your ordinary benefits, you know, the stuff that seems important to you now will not seem important in the priorities of the country, right? So you had best get prepared for that. And so I tell people it is very important to get to know better your family, your community, and everyone around you, because those things always become more important during fourth turnings. And you know, I'm a financial advisor. That's what I do as a day job. I mean, I work for Hedgeye Risk Management. And you know, as individuals, people say, you know, what can I do for long-term care insurance? And I just said, the market for long-term care insurance, haywire. You'd be insane actually paying those premiums. You're not gonna be satisfied with the benefits anyway, should you have to use them. You said, your long-term care insurance is your family. Just face it. I don't care if you like them or not. You better come to terms with them, because that is the bottom. I mean, you understand that, Adam. It's just the truth. Or it's your surrogate family. It's your intentional family. It's something, right? But you need to create that sense of community. That's my first lesson to people going forward. It's not going to be like the 1990s dream that we could just have our, you know, laptop and our Starbucks and move around the world being completely autonomous, disconnected. That dream will not be happening at the climax of the fourth turning. I think otherwise, when it comes to finances, look, I tell people it's going to be a very challenging time. By the late 2020s, the entire economically relevant world, by that I mean the entire high income world plus all the emerging markets, will actually be experiencing a decline in their working age populations in the aggregate. That's extraordinary. That's the first time that's happened since Adam Smith first wrote about, you know, the wealth of nations and the first glimmerings of the Industrial Revolution. This is something that we're not used to dealing with. And I think that's the backdrop in something that's pretty a generational crop, you know, in other words, a generational rhythm is going to be bad anyway, you know what I mean, on top of that. And so I think it's going to be a challenging time. Volatility has been it will be extraordinary. Diversification is obviously key, not just nominal diversification in terms of style factors, but real diversification, owning completely different kinds of assets in geographically diverse places, but make sure you can get your money back in a time of crisis from those places. I think Fixed nominal assets, you know, like bonds and so on, are always toast in a fourth turning. Inflation is always one of the means by which government recaptures the real value of its debt, right? I mean, that's always how it pays back part of its indebtedness. That happened in the Civil War, happened in the American Revolution, it happened in World War II, obviously. And so that combined with financial repression, in other words, the inability, you won't be able to sell those things. You won't be able to get out of those bank accounts. You will be forced to accept, you know, a rate of return far beneath the rate of inflation. And so getting out of those things and investing in real assets becomes very important. Commodities always do well. I think the manufacture of things, you remember in the fourth turning, we're rebuilding the outer world. I know in the 1990s and the last decade, we talked so much about experiences, you know, everyone's into experiences. Well, believe me, in the heat of a fourth turning, it's all going to be about things. It's going to be about building things, having commodities. So these very unsexy parts of the S&P that, you know, no one loved, you know, like materials. Well, when is the last time anyone was excited about investing in the material sector of the S&P? Manufacturing. Well, we've seen defense. Defense is already on our tear. And that's going to go up from here. Every country, every major country in the world is spending more on defense now. We're running out of missiles and bombs already just from the Ukraine. And as you know, the predictions are that, you know, a major flare up in the Western Pacific, the United States would be out of bombs and missiles in 48 hours. I mean, we have nothing left. So there's an enormous new agenda building up for this. And I think materials, building up the material world, is going to be something that's going to be huge in this new era. We're entering a time at which I think what the rising generation wants is not so much experiences. They want to build a real world from the top down on a large scale, and they want to scale it up, and it better be a better world that works. And this is going to involve parts of our economy that we haven't thought too much about. And obviously, nearshoring and homeshoring and all those trends are going to continue. So if your economic bet depends upon an acceleration or continuation of globalization, you might want to rethink that.
All right, Neil, that was scary, but fantastic. That's exactly the kind of direction that I was looking for, and very practical guidance that people can sort of take those main themes you mentioned and figure out, okay, how do I potentially start allocating my investments maybe a little bit differently than just the traditional, you know, paper-based investment portfolio. I've got so many questions about the fourth turning I'd still like to ask, but we're beginning to run out of time. I want to be respectful, and I do want to get to
this. We can do another show, Adam, some point.
Great. Well, I'd love to have you back on and do a full one just on the coming new seculum, the new first turning. But let's end talking a bit about that here. And as we transition into, as the dust begins to settle from however the destructive elements of the fourth turning play out, the sun comes up, the new hero avatars begin to create the new dawn. Which I think you describe as a high, right? That first turning is usually a high. I'd love to have you sort of talk about what are the key elements of that you see coming? I mean, you can't predict with exactitude, but you have a sense of the types of reform to expect. Let me ask you this question, if you could just wrap it into your answer, which is, I'm curious as to where the new leaders are going to come from. And the spirit of this question is, in a lot of the great turmoils of the past, whether they happened in a fourth turning or not, you had a lot of great voices that came out and they had a platform and they built a following around, and then it drove changes. And you know, I'm even thinking as recently as the late 60s with the civil rights movement and the women's movement and whatnot, equal rights movements, we'll call it. You had a lot of great leaders and new voices come out of that. But I kind of look around right now, I don't see very many. And I don't know if I'm just missing them or if this isn't the part yet in the turning where they emerge, or if we just have a bad batch this time around.
So, you know, Henry Kissinger, who I believe just had his 100th birthday. I mean, he's right about there, right? And he's a member of the GI generation, you know, and recalls Germany and the war and, you know, everything, right? He was once asked this question about what worries him most. And he gave an interesting answer, which I think echoes a little bit what the spirit of your question. And he said, what worries me most is the quality of leadership today.
Our interview with Neil will continue over in part two, which will be released on this channel tomorrow as soon as we're finished editing it. To be notified when it comes out, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already by clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And be sure to hit the like button too while you're down there. And if the challenges Neil has detailed in this interview have you feeling a little vulnerable about the prospects for your wealth, then consider scheduling a free, no strings attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help manage your wealth, keeping in mind the trends, risks, and opportunities that Neil's mentioned here. Just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set one up for you. Okay, I'll see you next over in part two of our interview with Neil Howe.